Sachs began by apologising that he had not heard of such a condition, but he said he was reminded of stories told to him by astronauts who said they had experienced times in space when everything looked wrong, upside down or at an angle. Their world would suddenly right itself when some clue, often a tactile one, allowed their orientation to become reorganised. Sachs also told her that the problem of not recognising familiar environments might be similar to another condition called prosopagnosia, in which people are unable to recognise familiar faces. On hearing this, Sharon took to the internet and googled prosopagnosia. She came across a website that tested how good you are at recognising faces. After the test, there was a questionnaire. Halfway through, one of the questions hit a nerve. Have you ever been in an environment that you know you should recognise but doesn't look familiar? I was like, holy shit, said Sharon, as a bemused waiter places our lunch on the table. I wrote everything about my condition in the notes section, trying to be as succinct as possible. Sharon pauses and turns to the waiter. She's writing a book about crazy people, she tells him, and I'm one of them, she laughs. Without any further explanation, she returns to her story. Within a week, I received a call from Brad Duquesne, a researcher at University College London. Duquesne had created the online test that Sharon had filled in as part of a project that attempted to work out what brain mechanisms allow us to recognise our family and friends. He was so sweet, says Sharon. He believed everything I said and assured me that at some point there would be someone doing research on my problem. I promise you, Duquesne had told her, when I find out who it is and where they live, I will let you know. He just really made me come out of my funk, says Sharon. He gave me hope that what I had was a real thing, that I wasn't just crazy, that I wasn't a witch. Later that year, Duquesne emailed her saying he had good news. There was an Italian researcher moving to Vancouver to start researching the condition that she had described. That man was Giuseppe Iaria, and shortly afterwards, Iaria contacted Sharon to invite her over to his lab. The first time Giuseppe called, I was sat at my kitchen table and I told him everything. He was such a gentleman. He nearly cried when I told him about the witch thing. Iaria told Sharon that he thought there might be a problem with the way in which the different navigational cells in her brain communicate with each other. Over the next 5 years, he began to test this theory. He started by scanning the brains of healthy people, looking at how different brain regions known to be important for orientation and navigation communicate with each other, and how that communication related to orientation skills. His team concluded that the best navigators were those with higher levels of communication among all the regions of the brain involved in navigation. This concept is called network theory, and it's an idea that underlies many human behaviours, that the connections between different regions of the brain that allow them to talk to one another may be more important than how well the regions function by themselves. It's like having a quartet of the world's best brass players who individually make wonderful sounds, but if they're not playing in time with each other, that music turns into mayhem. Iaria's team then went on to scan the brains of a group of people with Sharon's disorder. They noted a difference in the activity of their right hippocampus and parts of their frontal cortex, an area that allows us to draw all the information about navigation together and make judgments upon it. It's also an area involved in reasoning and general intelligence. Since Iaria's patients had no problem with their memory or their reasoning, he concluded that the condition must be a result of ineffective communication between the two regions, rather than a defect in each individual region alone. It's not enough for the individual parts of the brain to be able to speak, he told me. They have to have good conversational abilities too. Since then, Iaria's team has discovered that, just like Claire's, Sharon's brain looks anatomically normal, but several of the areas involved in navigation don't communicate properly. I understood how this could prevent Sharon from forming a mental map of her surroundings, but I was confused as to why she could sometimes navigate perfectly well. What causes the sudden flipping? I asked Iaria. Some people don't actually lack the skill of forming a mental map, he said. But somewhere in the process of collecting all the pieces of the puzzle, errors accumulate, information gets lost, and suddenly the map shifts. The condition appeared to have varying degrees of severity. The world of one of his patients would shift back and forth every minute of the day. One moment her brain was telling her the bathroom was on the left, the next it was on her right. It literally drove her crazy, he said. I asked Iaria what he thought of Sharon's spinning technique. He said he knew of others who seemed to be able to reset their mental map, normally by concentrating on things around them. But to his knowledge, Sharon's technique is unique. I have to admit, I have no idea why it works, he says. There's nothing wrong with her vestibular system. She doesn't get nauseous or have problems with her balance, but somehow shaking this system by spinning around resets her mental map. He sighed. I can scan her brain, but I can't enter her mind. Recently, Iaria has been testing his theory that developmental topographical disorientation has a genetic link. Of all the people he has identified with the condition, almost 200 of them, around 30% have at least one other family member affected by the problem. To confirm their suspicions, he and his colleagues have been sequencing their patients' entire genomes. They have identified a handful of potential genes that might be causing the problem. We're really close to identifying exactly what genes are responsible, he said. It's a huge step. This kind of research will allow doctors to sequence the genes of children whose family members suffer from the disorder and predict whether they too will develop navigation problems. While it's unlikely that they will be able to replace the broken genes anytime soon, it might be possible to intervene using brain training exercises that help children use other parts of their brain to learn how to navigate. The earlier we catch it, the more likely we can do something to teach that child to learn specific navigational skills that might not develop naturally, said Iaria. I wondered whether there was anything the rest of us can do to improve our navigational skills, or if it was too late by the time we've reached adulthood. Sure, said Iaria. If you're in a new area, you should return to one point, your home base, often, as this will help you build a better mental map. He said you should also pay more attention to your surroundings. Take note of specific landmarks and think about their orientation to one another. And don't forget to turn around or look backwards from time to time. It's a trick that animals do to make it easier to recognise their way home. As we leave the restaurant, I ask Sharon whether her daughter, son or grandchildren have any signs of the condition. No, thank goodness, they're all really good at navigating, she says. We walk a few steps in silence. Did Sharon's condition appear spontaneously, I wonder? Or might it have been inherited? Do you reckon... I begin. My mum, Sharon guesses. Yeah, I think she must have had it. Looking back, it all makes sense. She never told my dad about my condition, probably because she'd never told him about hers. She never walked us to school or picked us up from anywhere unless there were other people with us. The only time she ever left the house was when she was in the car with my father or visiting neighbours on our street. She never went anywhere by herself. Never. While it may be too late to help Sharon... Just knowing there are people out there trying to understand the condition has been enough to help her turn her life around. I've always been silly and funny because it misdirected people away from the things I was hiding. Everyone always said, "You're always in such a good mood." They didn't know that I would go home at night and cry. Now I don't need to. Now all my friends know what I've got and why I have to go off and do my Wonder Woman impression when we're out. That's not to say there aren't times when her condition is still a nuisance. Recently she got lost in a department store. She was late for a party, so in order to spin around and find her way back to her car, she grabbed a pair of shorts and ran into the changing room. Only then did she realise the shorts she was carrying were for a toddler. She walked out of the changing room with her head held high. I just told the shop assistant, sorry, they're a little small. I wonder, as we drive back to Sharon's house and I recognise a few of the turnings, whether her brain is completely different to mine, or whether she is just at the far end of a navigational spectrum on which we all sit. I later asked Iaria what he thought. He said that the condition certainly exists in varying degrees of severity, but based on what we know so far, it's not possible to conclude whether Sharon is at the bottom of the spectrum or off it completely. Look at it this way, he said. If you take 100 people and relocate them in a new city, some will begin to learn their way around the area within days. Others will take weeks. Some will take months. After a year, all of those people will know their way around with varying degrees of confidence. But take someone with Sharon's disorder to that city, and they will never be able to give you directions. Not after a year, not even after a decade. They will get lost every single day. The mechanisms involved are the same, but something, somewhere, is completely different to you or me. Sharon and I wander back into her house, where she points me in the direction of the kitchen, this time to a plate of banana bread that she's made for my flight home. We stand in front of her fridge again, arguing about how many pieces of cake I can legitimately take through security. Sharon insists I should take the whole plate. I compromise and carefully wrap 3 slices in a piece of tinfoil. I would later receive texts and emails from her, checking I had got home safely. I tell her that I am amazed, given what she has been through, that she is so nice, so normal. I know she won't take offence to the word. She glances back at the fridge. The way you see me now is because of Giuseppe. I wasn't this person before I saw Giuseppe. I was still a scared little girl. I don't think I really grew up and became a woman until the last 10 years, really. I'm a happy person now. I realised that in order to be fulfilled, I needed to learn to like myself and accept who I am. She smiles. Now I have Wonder Woman on my refrigerator. I'm really proud of what I am today. Out on her doorstep, I catch another glimpse of her giant lobster lawn ornament waving at me. I know he's awful, says Sharon, as she walks me to my car, but I call him Louis. She looks back at the house. If I'm lost trying to find my way around all the condos and I see Louis, I know I'm home. On the plane, I look at a picture the two of us had taken together in the restaurant. Sharon's bright red hair and beaming smile shine out. From the outside, you would never know there was anything strange about the way she sees the world. Yet her mountains can leap from one direction to another. The home she recognises can change in an instant. We're slowly creeping closer towards an idea of why this happens, just how the different cells in and around our hippocampus communicate with each other to form our internal GPS. Perhaps one day we'll know enough to fix it when it goes wrong. But in the meantime, I wonder how many others are out there like Sharon hiding a similar secret. People who are making excuses, working out tricks, driving themselves into depression for fear of being stigmatised. All because we find it so difficult to compare objectively how we see the world. Beautiful, isn't it? Says the man sitting next to me, pointing out of the window. I glance down at the twinkling lights of London coming into view and smile in agreement. But I have a peculiar feeling in my stomach. A few days ago I would have taken it for granted that we were appreciating the same thing, the dark blue curve of the River Thames, the silhouette of the Houses of Parliament. But Sharon had taught me that it was entirely possible that this gentleman and I were seeing the world completely different to one another. I look at my neighbour, thinking about whether my London resembles his. As we approach the city, the distinctive lights of the Shard growing larger in the window, I wonder, is there any way of finding out? Chapter 3. Reuben. Seeing Auras. I squint as the bright sunshine greets me at the end of the tunnel. My bus rumbles past the Guggenheim Museum, with its erratic curves of stone, glass and titanium gleaming brightly. Further down the road I am joined by a gigantic dog, 20 feet tall, covered with multicoloured blooms. In the distance a needle-thin tower soars into the sky, squeezed between a Gothic church and row upon row of orange-roofed apartments. This is Bilbao, a Spanish city that sits at the northern tip of the Iberian Peninsula. It is early morning and the temperature is already climbing. I am due to meet a fellow journalist, someone who I'm hoping will help me understand how other people's worlds differ from my own. But first I have to find him. I hop off the bus at a huge roundabout and try to figure out which of its 7 exits to take. I am newly grateful for an ability to bring to mind a mental map of my surroundings, but I'm still finding it difficult to know which way to turn. I briefly consider attempting some Spanish to ask for directions, before deciding instead to follow the sounds of ABBA's Chiquiquita being strummed on a sitar. This takes me out across the Nervión River that runs through the city, dividing its districts. My final destination, an opera house called the Teatro Arriaga, is visible just across the bridge. I settle down on the amphitheatre steps that lead into the theatre, then sit back and give every man that passes a lingering stare. In the end, with his thick brown beard, black-rimmed glasses and heavy-set frame, 30-year-old Ruben Diaz Cavieres isn't hard to miss. He turns towards me as I jump down the steps, waving awkwardly. We meet at the bottom. I hold out my hand. He ignores it. We do it the Spanish way, he says, giving me a kiss on either cheek. I must look surprised. Not the kisses, but his voice. Ah, yes, my accent, he says. I'm told I sound like a posh Englishman. I laugh and we chat easily as Ruben leads me towards Bilbao's old town in search of a traditional Basque breakfast, a large black coffee. As we amble along the city's cobbled streets, Ruben explains how he travelled to Bilbao from a village just along the coast, where he works for a contemporary culture magazine. Until recently he lived in Madrid and then Barcelona, but moved to the countryside for a better work-life balance. For the mountains and the greenery, he says, the things you can't buy with money. Ruben's new life is in his hometown of Royloba, where some of his family still live. He is the oldest child of 3, all boys, 2.5 years apart. His childhood was a happy one, but unremarkable. Reuben was 21 when he first realised that he had an extraordinary brain. But to find out more, I have to ask him a question that I know he is going to detest. Reuben, you're going to hate me for using this word, but is it auras that you see? Reuben takes a deep breath. Yes, I suppose, if you have 3 hours to explain it, he says. But if you have just a few minutes with someone and you tell them that, then people are going to think you're a magic leprechaun or... He pauses, searching for the right words in English. Or a twat. In 1997, Loftur Gissarason, an Icelandic scientist working in Reykjavik, invited 10 remarkable people into his lab. All 10 claimed they could see auras. Auras are perhaps most commonly associated with religion, often seen floating around the bodies of Mary and Jesus in Christian artwork. They are alluded to in many spiritual practices as chi, prana, or chakra, mystical energy centres that are said to coincide with 7 major areas of the human nervous system. They have been described as a halo of colour or light, or an electromagnetic field that surrounds all creatures, emanations thought to reflect health, mood, and enlightenment. The majority of the scientific establishment dismisses them. I asked Gissarason, now a managing director at a geothermal company in Reykjavik, but once described by peers as a jovial, convivial, pipe-smoking parapsychologist, which camp he was in. He said that for him it was purely a matter of experimentation. He had been interested in studying the aura because at the time the phenomenon had not been put to the test, scientifically speaking. A number of ostensible psychics claimed to be able to see auras, and I was curious to see how it would make out in a controlled situation in a lab, he said. Paranormal activity had long captured his imagination. He wrote his PhD thesis on Indridi Indridason, Iceland's first and most prolific medium. In a book he later co-authored, he details the investigation of the phenomena produced by Indridason, which included making his own arm disappear, levitating and evoking the appearance of multiple voices during seances. So prolific were Indridason's talents that several distinguished scientists, including Gudmundur Hannesson, a professor of medicine, twice president of the University of Iceland and a member of parliament, studied him at close quarters. Hannesson's records were meticulous. During seances in which objects would appear to fly around the room, Hannesson would attempt to limit every conceivable means of deception. He'd place a net around the room. He would hold Indridason's feet and hands. He'd investigate the possible use of mirrors or accomplices. At the end of his study, he remarked that at almost every seance he noticed something that he considered suspicious, and that the next one would be especially vigilant on that particular point. But, he concluded, in spite of all precautions, I was never able to ascertain any fraud. On the contrary, the bulk of the phenomena were, as far as I could judge, quite genuine, whatever their cause may have been. Almost a century later, Gissarason and his colleague, Asegir Gunnarsson, lined up 4 large wooden panels in an empty room. Gunnarsson hid behind one of the panels, decided by the roll of a dice, and waited for Gissarason to bring each of their 10 participants into the room one by one. Standing at the doorway, each participant was asked to say behind which screen Gunnarsson was hidden. The researchers reasoned that the participants should be able to tell based on Gunnarsson's aura, which would be streaming out from behind the screen. Each participant repeated the experiment over and over again. The pair then invited 9 people who said they had no extrasensory ability to take part in the test. They tried hard to minimise any aspect that could potentially reveal Gunnarsson's position. The walls were covered in opaque wallpaper to prevent any reflections giving the game away. The participants were given ear defenders and listened to music between each test to stop them hearing the researchers' footsteps. Gunnarsson even took a shower just before the experiment to prevent any lingering musk from revealing his position. The results were conclusive. Neither group was able to guess which panel Gunnarsson was standing behind any better than chance. And, ironically, the control group actually did slightly better than the group that claimed they could see auras. Gissarason wasn't alone in giving paranormal activity a chance at scientific validation. In 1964, James Randi, a renowned magician and escape artist, now best known as a tireless investigator of paranormal and pseudoscientific claims, offered $1,000 of his own money to the first person who could offer him proof of the paranormal under controlled conditions. Today, his prize lies untouched, and thanks to various donors, has grown to $1 million. Although hundreds of people have tried, all attempts at claiming the money have failed. Most notable was a live experiment on ABC's primetime programme Nightline, where a psychic, a palm reader and a tarot card reader all had their talents put to the test. All of them failed. "I have an open mind," said Randy, after the show had aired, "but not so open my brains fall out." "And that," says Reuben, "is why I don't tell people I can see auras." He and I are sitting under a large cream umbrella in a small square tucked away in Bilbao's old town. I flag down a waiter. Reuben sits forward in his chair. "First of all," he says, quite seriously, "I don't want anybody to think that I see auras in the very conventional sense of the word, like I'm some kind of fortune teller or that I can also read hands." I nod. "What in fact happens is that I perceive colours when I see people. Everyone has a distinctive colour, which changes with time depending on how I know that person, or the main attributes of that person." "Attributes?" "Like their name or their voice, what they're wearing, and the emotion that I'm feeling towards them." "Can you physically see the colour in front of you?" "That's the most difficult thing to explain. It's not a hallucination, not something visually happening in front of you, but at the same time I'm aware it's there. I can't avoid seeing it." But Reuben does not have paranormal talents. He has a rare variant of synesthesia, the condition we came across in Chapter 1 that causes a blending of the senses. For hundreds of years, it was received wisdom that our senses travel along their own individual paths in the brain, never talking to one another directly. We see because of impulses that travel from the eye through the optic nerve to the visual cortex. We hear because air triggers electrical messages in the ear that are passed to the auditory cortex and perceived as sound. In 1812, that wisdom was challenged by George Tobias Ludwig Sachs, a young man born in the mountain village of St. Ruprecht an der Raab in Austria, in a dissertation that he published describing his own albinism, a condition in which a lack of melanin causes a person's hair and skin to become pale white. In his essay, he also remarks upon another phenomenon in which colours appeared when he listened to music, or when he thought about numbers, days, cities, or letters. He says that these concepts introduce themselves to the mind as if a series of visible objects in dark space, formless and noticeably of different colours. It wasn't until the 1880s that Sir Francis Galton, a polymath from Birmingham in England, named Sachs' condition synesthesia, a term that comes from the Greek meaning joined perception. A synesthete, you remember, might experience the number 5 as having a pink hue, or taste strawberry at the sound of a horn. Music might be perceived as having a particular shape. Months of the year might be seen as a ribbon in space. My favourite description of synesthesia comes from the Russian author Vladimir Nabokov. "The long A of the English alphabet has, for me, the tint of weathered wood, but a French A evokes polished ebony," he says in his autobiography. "I am puzzled by my French on, which I see as the brimming tension surface of alcohol in a small glass. In the brown group, there are the rich, rubbery tone of soft G, paler J, and the drab shoelace of H." Synesthesia is by and large a completely harmless trait and occurs in around 4% of the population. Many people are synesthetes without ever realising. Undoubtedly, these strange perceptions would once have been regarded as witchcraft. Even in the last century, synesthetes were often diagnosed with schizophrenia or taken as drug addicts. Thankfully, the landscape has changed radically in the last few decades. Scientists no longer ask whether it is real, but why it occurs and whether it is beneficial. Although the debate over the mechanisms that give rise to synesthesia is by no means settled, the increasing sophistication of imaging techniques has allowed us to compare the structure of the brain and patterns of electrical activity in synesthetes and non-synesthetes. At first glance, the synesthetic brain looks much like any other. It has the same tangled heap of neurons that we all possess. But upon closer inspection, there may be subtle differences. As we discovered earlier, neurons in the infant brain form millions of connections that are not present in later life. As we grow and learn and experience the world, a huge amount of connections are pruned. Some small studies have suggested that people with synesthesia may have a genetic anomaly that prevents this pruning from happening in certain brain areas. As a result, synesthetes are left with pathways of communication between sensory regions of the brain that don't normally exist. While these structural changes and co-activation of disparate regions of the brain may indeed increase a person's propensity to link different senses, it doesn't fully explain the mechanism behind synesthesia. It doesn't explain how synesthesia can be induced temporarily after taking hallucinogenic drugs, for instance, nor does it explain the handful of cases in which people have lost synesthetic experiences while taking antidepressants. In fact, it seems that anyone can become a synesthete. In 2014, Daniel Bohr at the University of Sussex and his colleagues managed to turn 33 adults into temporary synesthetes in just over a month. Their volunteers took part in half-hour training sessions 5 days a week in which they learned 13 letter and colour associations. By week five, many of the volunteers were reporting that they saw coloured letters when they read regular black text. "When reading a sign on campus, I saw all the letter E's coloured green," said one participant. If you want to try it for yourself, you can download ebooks in which certain letters always appear in specific colours. Before long, you should start seeing those letters appear in colour elsewhere in the world. The effect doesn't seem to last long if you don't continue to practice. 3 months after the trial finished, the volunteer's synesthesia had disappeared. The fact that synesthesia can appear and disappear in these ways challenges the pruning theory. It's not possible for new connections to sprout suddenly and then disappear in such short time frames. The Indian-born neuroscientist Vilina Ramachandran poses a different theory. He and his colleagues at the University of California, San Diego, believe that synesthetes may actually have an enhancement of pre-existing connections between their senses that everybody possesses. We know that there are several areas of the brain that inhibit each other. In this way, neighbouring areas of the brain can be insulated from one another. There's some evidence to suggest that a chemical imbalance might reduce this inhibition, either by blocking chemicals that pass electrical messages across synapses, or by failing to produce them at all. This would not create any extra connections in the brain, but would prevent some connections from being inhibited, with the result that regions normally shut off from one another would start communicating. If this theory proves true, you might imagine that we all have some aspects of synesthesia within us. And when we look closer, it turns out we do. Imagine you have in front of you a rounded cloud-like shape and a shape that resembles a jagged piece of shattered glass. Which would you name Booba and which would you name Kiki? Most people would name the rounded cloud Booba and the jagged shape Kiki. This is the most likely answer, no matter whether you are an English-speaking person or not. This intriguing experiment, developed by Ramachandran, shows that while we may not see colours when listening to music or looking at numbers, when pressed, we all tend to link certain senses, like pairing high-pitched sounds with bright colours and low tones with deeper hues. Such experiments suggest that there is a non-arbitrary, inbuilt relationship between all of our senses. It suggests that synesthetes do not have a completely different brain to the rest of us. They may simply have a more extreme manifestation of what we all possess to a greater or lesser degree. It's not clear how many kinds of synesthesia there are, and new types are being described all the time. In 2016, Jamie Ward at the University of Sussex discovered that some synesthetes who are fluent in sign language experience the same colour they associate with written letters when the corresponding letter is signed. Then there are the more unusual kinds of synesthesia, the ticker tape synesthete, for instance, who sees words flowing out of other people's mouths as they speak, or the orgasm colour synesthete, who senses bright colours at the point of climax. Reuben's synesthesia is thought to be one of the rarest, in that he experiences all sorts of cross-senses. He perceives colours when he sees or hears letters, numbers, names, music, shapes or heights, when he thinks about certain ideas, and also when he feels strong emotions. This emotion-colour synesthesia is what leads to his most interesting perceptions, a world of colourful auras evoked by the people around him. Sometimes the colour he associates with someone is completely arbitrary. At other times, certain colours are associated with specific emotions that he has towards the person. "So does everyone have a colour associated with them?" I asked Reuben, pointing at a random woman walking past our table. "Like her? What colour is she?" "No, not everyone," Reuben replies, giving her the briefest of glances. "The colours I see are primarily influenced by the sound of the person's name, what they are wearing, how I feel about them, or how attractive they are. The colours Reuben sees often are blue, grey, red, yellow, and orange. For instance, if I like someone sexually, they would be red, he says. It won't matter about the voice, just the look, because that's the first thing you think about a person. It's not just people, but also music, paintings, and buildings. Things I like always tend to make me perceive some kind of red. People who look dirty or sick, on the other hand, will normally be perceived by Reuben as having a green aura, whereas those who are optimistic and happy are purple. If I don't like someone, their colour will probably be yellow. Yellow is the colour I associate with acidic flavours, and it's also the colour of people with bad manners, who are rude or have some kind of attitude. So if a person acts like that, he or she becomes yellow. Reuben doesn't always have an explanation for why certain colours are associated with certain people. One of his brothers is pale orange, the other is grey. His mother is a grey-blue. He has no idea why. Likewise, his father is brown. Brown is the colour Reuben normally associates with the elderly and people who are uninteresting to him, yet his father is neither of those things. In their case, it doesn't have anything to do with emotions. It's more to do with their identity and how their voice sounds. Sometimes people's colour changes, he says, sipping his coffee. I had a boyfriend up until a few years ago, and the first time we met, I remember thinking he was this bright red. But he had this amazing voice and these blue, almost green eyes, and those two things, the colour of his voice and the colour of his eyes, were so distinctive that they mixed, and that became his colour. It was this pale grey. No one else had that colour. The relationship between colour and emotion is well established in the animal kingdom. Female animals often use the colour red to signal hormonal changes in their body associated with fertility, for example. Certain male primates show red following a surge of testosterone in their bloodstream due to aggression or a show of dominance. Testosterone suppresses the immune system, so the flush of red tells any females that the male must be in good health to cope with such deficits. There's plenty of research suggesting that colour affects us too. Consider this simple yet remarkable social experiment conducted in 2010 by Daniela Kayser, a psychologist at the University of Rochester, New York. Kayser wondered whether a lady in red really was more alluring, so she and her colleagues asked several men to have a conversation with a woman who was wearing either a red or green shirt. Men who spoke to the woman while she was wearing a red shirt asked her more intimate questions than those who spoke to her while she was wearing green. In another experiment, men sat closer to a woman and classed her as more attractive when she was wearing a red shirt than when she was wearing an identical shirt in other colours. The results certainly fit with our mainstream ideals of red being linked to a woman's allure, passion and fertility. But men, take note, over a series of 7 experiments, Kayser's colleague Andrew Elliott demonstrated that women also perceived men to be more attractive, more desirable and considerably more likeable when they were wearing red clothing. Colours also influence other aspects of our behaviour. In humans, aggression and dominance are associated with reddening of the face due to increased blood flow. Perhaps this is why we refer to seeing red when angered. Evolutionary anthropologists at Durham University and the University of Plymouth wondered whether wearing a red shirt might exploit our innate response to the colour red and so influence the outcomes of sporting contests. They studied 55 years' worth of English Football League results and found that teams whose home colours were red won 2% more often than teams who wore blue or white, and 3% more often than those who wore yellow or orange. In fact, across a range of sports, wearing red is consistently associated with a higher probability of winning. Robert Barton, who worked on the football study, also analysed the results from 4 combat sports in the 2004 Olympic Games. Despite the athletes having been randomly assigned red or blue outfits in which to compete, those who wore red won 55% of the fights. Barton says it's not completely clear why this happens, whether the colour red affects the wearer, the perceiver, or the referee. There is some evidence that wearing red increases feelings of confidence and hormone levels, he says. There's also evidence that the colour red can affect the judgments of referees, and that people associate the colour with dominance, aggression, and anger, which might have subtle effects on an opponent's performance. It's an interesting question as to why in so many cultures red becomes associated with the same kind of things, says Barton. It suggests there is some universality about it, whether that is a direct reflection of an evolutionary heritage or something else that makes red so salient. Despite this uncertainty, it seems that colours do unwittingly affect us all, day by day. If Ramachandran's theory that we have a non-arbitrary, inbuilt relationship between the senses is correct, we might all have the anatomical connections in place to link emotions and colours. It's just for most of the time, we inhibit these pathways to varying degrees. Perhaps this is why the colour red influences our behaviour in subtle but provocative ways. At the very least, it might give you a few ideas for what to wear on a first date. An accordion player edges nearer to our table, so we decide to make a move. I pay for our coffees as Reuben resumes his tale, recollecting some of the things that happened to him as a child that in retrospect seem relevant to his synesthesia. "I've always hated my hands," he says, holding them up to my face. "They're like giant baby hands." I suppress a smile. They are very much like giant baby hands. Thick, stubby fingers on squishy, circular palms. The weird thing is that I used my right hand to draw, and I was quite good at drawing, so I started to like my right hand, but I still hated my left. Whenever I would imagine my hands, I would see the right one as this beefy Conan character, and the other one as a little evil character. I'm pretty sure that had something to do with my brain making strong visual representations based on my emotions. Other strange things happened as Reuben was growing up. There was a period when he would perceive a woman dancing when he looked at certain things, his teachers, his friends, even his dog. He couldn't avoid seeing it. These strange perceptions, which had started off as flickers of dancing women and pantomime hands, had, by the time he was a teenager, solidified themselves as auras. "There was clearly always something weird happening in my brain," he says. As we wander away from the hustle of the old town, through a maze of small side streets in search of something to eat, I wonder whether the colours that Reuben perceives gives him any kind of special insight into his emotions. Do you ever see someone and notice that you're perceiving a red aura, say, and think, "Oh, I must fancy him," I ask. Reuben laughs. "No, it doesn't work like that. When it's happening, the colour is the effect of the emotion. The order of events are person, emotion, then colour. So I already know what emotion I'm feeling." He pauses. "Except, actually, sometimes it's the colour, then the emotion and the person." He searches the crowd for a moment and points at a passing tourist. When your emotions are linked with colours, it tends to go both ways. So I might see someone in bright red trousers, and because I associate red with love or attractiveness, I could be aroused by that person or think better of them. You know it's something stupid and irrational, but it tends to get inside your brain because you can't ignore it. You have to tell yourself, this person isn't nice just because they're wearing red. "So might you think someone was nasty because they were wearing a colour that you associate with rudeness?" I say, glancing down at my blue dress, racking my brain to remember what emotion Reuben associates with that colour. "Exactly," he says. "If they were wearing something very yellow, or I see someone with a green aura because that's the colour I associate with their voice, I might feel tempted to think that person is less nice because their greenness makes me feel a certain way. Isn't that kind of annoying?" "It could be, but the important thing is that I'm perfectly aware that it is irrational. I know these feelings are stupid, I just have to fight them. None of it is real." "Do you think you've been this way ever since you were born?" Reuben stops and thinks for a moment. "I have the sense that I could always see colours associated with people, but when you don't experience anything different, you don't realise it's unusual." In fact, it wasn't until 2005 that Reuben became aware of his synesthesia at all. He was hanging out with a friend who was studying psychology at the University of Granada. She told him that she was involved in an investigation into synesthesia. He had never heard of the word, so she explained what it was. Like many others in the past, Reuben didn't understand why it was worth investigating. "I was like, yeah, what of it?" said Reuben. "That's completely normal." His friend was surprised and told him that she thought he might be a synesthete. "Then suddenly she went completely white," says Reuben. "She remembered that I was colourblind." In order to see the kaleidoscope of colour in our world, we use specialised cells in the retina called photoreceptors. These absorb light and convert it into electrical signals. There are two kinds of photoreceptors, rods and cones. Rods help us to see in dim light, but are not sensitive to colour. Cones, on the other hand, respond strongly to red, green or blue. When wavelengths of light hit our cones, they respond optimally to their favourite colour, or to a lesser extent, to wavelengths of light that are close to their favoured colour. For example, cones that favour red light also respond to orange and slightly to yellow, but don't respond at all to green and blue. The combination of activity from all three types of photoreceptor is sent to an area of the visual cortex called V4, where it is interpreted as the many shades of colour that make up our technicolour world. However, for people who are colourblind, like Ruben, some of these photoreceptors are deficient, resulting in the loss of a whole spectrum of colour. Ruben has a common form of colourblindness that makes it difficult to tell the difference between colours that have some aspect of red or green in them. I can tell the difference between a lettuce green and a lipstick red, but colours in between, like purple and some blues and oranges, get mixed up, he says. Being colourblind has given Ruben a bit of a complex about colours, and was the reason, he reckons, that he never really let himself think much about the colours he perceived around people, letters and buildings. What bothered you so much, I ask? You know when you're in kindergarten and painting a picture and you need a crayon? I nod. Well, I would be painting a picture of a person, and I'd ask for a pink crayon. The other kids would give me another colour and wait for me to paint the face blue. They'd do it as a joke, but I didn't like it. You're only three, your only job is to learn the colours, and you're not able to do it. It's not nice, you know? Ruben remembers one time when he painted a horse. It was a decent horse, he says, but when the teacher came over to take a look, she was really, really impressed. Then she asked him why it was green. I was so embarrassed about it being green, says Ruben. I just said, because it's nicer. That particular teacher, not knowing Ruben was colourblind, was reminded of a printmaker called Franz Marc, who painted a famous picture of blue horses against red hills. Marc used colours to express strong emotional meaning or purpose. Ruben's teacher wondered whether she was seeing the start of something quite profound in this young boy. She was so impressed with his artwork that she invited his parents to the school to discuss his future. She told them I had been doing these wonderful, colourful paintings. She thought I was a genius, said Ruben. My mum was like, no, he's really not. But Ruben's teacher was right. There was something special about him. After Ruben's friend recovered from her shock, she took him to the University of Granada to meet her supervisor, Emilio Gomez, a cognitive psychologist. He was quite emotional when we first met, says Ruben. I don't think anyone thought a colourblind synesthete could exist. The reason that Gomez was so excited to meet Ruben was that he believed he might be able to offer a novel insight into the question I'd first considered on the plane back from Sharon's. Does my world look like yours? Scientists call this concept qualia. To understand its meaning, imagine I'm an alien visiting Earth from another planet. I ask you, what do you see when you look at that red apple over there? You could tell me all of the physiological mechanisms that occur when you look at the apple. You could explain how wavelengths of light hit your eyeballs and send signals towards areas of the brain that process colour. You could tell me about all the other things that look red, or how it makes you feel. But your description leaves out something completely ineffable, your actual perception of what red is. We are fundamentally unable to transfer the experience of our world to other people. What we are starting to realise, though, is that we don't always see things in the same way. Never was this more obvious than in February 2015, when the world stumbled upon a certain blue and black dress. Or maybe, like me, you thought it was white and gold. In case you missed the year's biggest debate, it surrounded a simple photo of a perfectly nice blue and black striped bodycon dress. If you haven't seen it, I urge you to Google it immediately. The photo was uploaded by 21-year-old Caitlin McNeil, an aspiring singer from Scotland, after some of her friends swore the photo showed a white and gold dress. Social media went into overdrive. People in the blue and black camp could not understand why so many of their friends were seeing white and gold. The actress Ellen DeGeneres tweeted, "From this day on, the world will be divided into two people, blue and black or white and gold." Scientists rushed to cobble together an explanation. When light hits an object, they said, some of it is absorbed and some of it is reflected. The wavelengths of the reflected light determine the colour we see. The light waves hit the retina at the back of the eye and activate our cones. A combination of activity from the cones is sent to the visual cortex in the brain, which processes all sorts of visual aspects such as movement and object recognition, before eventually producing the perception of colour. So far, so good. However, those wavelengths of light are actually a product of whatever colours of light are currently around you, reflecting off the object you're viewing. The light that illuminates our world changes throughout the day, from the pinkish light of dawn to the bright white neon lights of your office, and everything in between. Without you being aware of it, your brain considers what colour light is bouncing off the object in your vision and makes certain adjustments to compensate. This mechanism allows you to walk through shadows or in and out of a brightly lit room while keeping the colours of your world stationary. Scientists decided that the dress must lie on some kind of perceptual boundary. In other words, it wasn't clear in what light it was taken, which meant that some people's brains adjusted for a bluish light and ended up seeing the dress as white and gold, while others, correctly as it happens, discounted the gold end of the spectrum and ended up seeing it as black and blue. I find it difficult to look at the dress and not be just a little alarmed, because it reveals something of qualia that we so often take for granted, that the colours I see are not always the colours that you see. And for Gomez, Ruben's colour blindness, together with his synesthesia, was the perfect way of gaining a unique insight into this unexplainable matter. But first, he had to prove that Ruben was telling the truth. Ruben stared at the 100th image that day and pointed to a colour chart that correlated with the aura the image produced. It was 2010, and Gomez had asked him to complete this task so that he had a record of what colour auras Ruben associated with certain images of faces, animals, letters and numbers. There were so many images it would have been impossible for Ruben to memorise each one. A month later, Gomez surprised Ruben by asking him to repeat the task. His answers matched almost 100% of the time. Satisfied that the test had been passed, Gomez's team devised a personalised Stroop test for Ruben. The original version of this test asks participants to name the colour of a word, not what that word says. For example, if the word red was written in blue ink, you would say blue. People find this task much easier when the word and the colour of the ink match. We can read words more quickly than we can process colours, so when the two are incongruent, it makes the brain stumble, meaning it takes longer to reach the correct answer. Gomez's team tweaked this test in a number of different ways to evaluate Ruben's claims. In one, they asked him to state whether a number was odd or even, but presented these numbers in coloured inks. The inks either matched or contrasted with the colour of the aura that Ruben perceived when he read the number. Ruben's reaction times were quicker when the colour of the number matched the colour of the aura it produced. We're not talking seconds here, but mere fractions of a second quicker every time, something that would be impossible to fake consistently. Since the colours of the numbers are arbitrary for people who don't see auras, their reaction times were similar across the board. Once he was convinced that Ruben was telling the truth, Gomez began to devise a way of testing whether Ruben's auras affected his behaviour. To do this objectively, he needed to test the behaviour over which Ruben had no conscious control, his heart rate. Gomez showed that Ruben's heart rate rose ever so slightly when looking at pictures where there was an incongruence between the aura they produced and the content of the picture. For instance, when an attractive man was wearing green. The feelings of attraction were at odds with the emotions that the green clothes produced. It was an image that was described by Ruben as being emotionally inconsistent. In contrast, the heart rates of people who don't have emotion colour synesthesia and who took the same test didn't fluctuate at all. It seemed reasonable to conclude, said Gomez, that Ruben's bodily reactions were a unique result of his qualia, or experience of colour. Although it doesn't tell us exactly what Ruben sees, it does answer my question of whether our worlds look alike. The answer is no. Ruben and I are discussing this complex concept when he says something that makes me stop quite literally in the middle of the street. Although he cannot tell the difference between shades of green in real life, he says, he sees a number of shades of green aura. I only have one type of red in my mind, the red I see in real life, but I have a number of greens, not just one. I am startled by his omission. It suggests that Ruben can see colours in his mind that don't exist for him in real life. He likens it to seeing someone in a dream. You can't see their face, but you know who it is, despite how they look. There are other qualities of his auras that don't exist in real life. The colours are textured, translucent, he says. Some have a sparkly glitteriness about them. It turns out that there is only one other person known to have this extraordinary and rare combination of synesthesia and colour blindness. He is Spike Jahan, and he is a student of Ramachandran. Jahan approached Ramachandran shortly after he had attended a lecture on synesthesia. He told Ramachandran that he was colourblind and had trouble distinguishing reds, greens, browns and oranges. He also had number colour synesthesia. However, the colours Jahan saw in his mind were tinged with colours that he had never seen in the real world. He called them Martian colours. I asked Ramachandran to explain this mysterious phenomenon to me. He said that Jahan has deficiencies in his cones, meaning he is unable to see certain colours in real life. Yet those deficiencies are in his eyes and not in his brain. The part of the brain that processes colour is perfectly normal. Somehow, when Jahan looks at a number, the shape of the number is processed normally, but then crossed wires activate the colour area in his visual cortex, which triggers the sensation of colours that he is unable to see in the real world. Although Ramachandran has not studied Reuben, he said he would guess that a similar thing is happening in his brain. Perhaps parts of his brain that deal with emotions are able to stimulate areas of the visual cortex, which enables him to perceive shades of green that he is unable to perceive in reality. Despite being single case studies, it hints at yet another mysterious aspect of qualia. Jahan and Reuben's Martian colours suggest that what you call red is not determined purely by light waves or the photoreceptors in your eyes, but is an innate concept produced by the activation of certain colour regions in your brain. It suggests that colour doesn't have to be activated via visual stimulation, but is an experience that can be a property of shape, sounds or emotions. Perhaps in the future, says Ramachandran, we'll be able to stimulate those colour regions alone to discover what strange experience they might provoke. A feeling of redness, a sound or taste of redness, a weird mass of redness unattached to a particular object. Maybe then, he says, we'll be able to find out exactly what red is. Distracted by these thoughts, Reuben and I somehow end up sitting outside a tourist trap selling bad paella. As we push food around our plates, I ask Reuben how his auras affect him day by day. He says he is intrigued about what is happening in his brain and more than happy to take part in experiments, but generally he tries to ignore them. I don't really think about them much on a daily basis, Reuben frowns, taking a drag on an e-cigarette. I think it's because if you stop and think about it too much, you feel very stupid. If it was me, I say, I might think about using my auras to make myself feel better about myself. Maybe wear something red because it makes you feel attractive. He shakes his head. You might feel tempted to wear a certain kind of clothing because of the emotion associated with it. You could do that, but that would be stupid because it's a language nobody else speaks. I tell him about Daniela Kayser's experiments with men and women wearing red shirts and that in fact we might all speak his language to some degree. That's interesting, he says. It's quite comforting to know I'm not completely weird. He glances down at his black top. I don't actually own any red t-shirts. I mainly wear black and white. I've never thought of it before, but perhaps I wear those colours more because I don't get much emotion with black or white. He smiles and looks up, or maybe because they're just more flattering for a big boy like me. As I signal for the bill, Reuben asks me a question. Do you want to know what colour I see myself? Yes, I hadn't considered that his auras would extend to his own reflection. He looks slightly embarrassed. Red, he says, I know that sounds like I love myself or something, all very Freudian, but I think it's because I like myself. I am happy with myself. Reuben kindly offers to drive me to the airport. As we walk to the car, I find myself contemplating the scenery around us, the deep blue of the Nervion River and the dark green mountains in the background. If it is true that colours are innate, that they can be triggered by any kind of sense, that we are all synesthetes to some extent, then surely we don't have to have sensory anomalies as extreme as Reuben's to experience the world ever so slightly different from one another. Perhaps the only aspect of qualia that we can ever be sure of is that your red is never going to be exactly the same as mine. It gives me an excited jolt deep in my stomach. It was fun to think that my world might look completely unique, that there was something about the world that was mine and mine only. As Reuben and I cross a bridge and amble along a towpath that runs alongside the river, my thoughts turn to a question I've been wanting to ask all day. Reuben?
Yes?
Do I have an aura? It feels strange asking. I know his colours don't always represent a specific emotion,